some interest in the issue we're going to discuss today. This is a work session on House Bill 2278 relating to public bodies. And the purpose of today's meeting is to discuss amendments to the bill which would purport to resolve or try to find a solution to the Fire District 10 issue. And it's extremely complex, so we're going to begin with Mr. Ellsworth, who's going to come up, and he's prepared some fairly substantial documents and a chronology of events or analysis of how it is we've gotten to this point. And I think from that place we'll then move on and hopefully get some testimony and other comments by individuals here. The objective, I think, and the hope of the committee is to find a solution that's equitable and that would work for all of the parties, but we're, I think, going to see it's extremely complex and hopefully be able to resolve it. Mark, I wanted to thank you for putting so much effort and energy into doing the analysis, and of course thank all of the other participants who responded to your questions and so on and so forth. So with that, I think I'll turn it over to you and allow you to give us a presentation.
Thank you, Chair Minnis. I am Mark Ellsworth, Committee Services. As you indicated, this is a complex issue. I will briefly outline a little bit of the history of it, and there will be individuals here that can speak to some specifics of the case following. You, in fact, have before you today an orphan, a problem without parents, without responsibility. The child has been around for some time and is now reaching adolescence and adulthood and is grown. The baby is on the doorstep still of the legislature. It started about two decades ago. Earlier on than that, in the 70s, Fire District 10 was probably the second largest rural fire protection district west of the Rocky Mountains and the second largest fire department in the state of Oregon. In July of 1982, the district joined PERS after substantial analysis of its options and realized that even though it was meeting the equal to or better than standard, it made financial sense to leave Connecticut General and join PERS. At that time, there were probably 200 employees and 11 retirees, 7 disabled retirees. Also in the mix, the 7 or 11 did not integrate at that time. It stayed with Connecticut General. They intended to finance this debt that they decided to incur over about 30 years, and the debt was, let's provide full benefits for these retirees. And so they came without the necessary assets for the system, and so they entered with this higher contribution rate to handle this amortization.
All right, so Mark, just let me ask the question then. They intended to finance it, and they were doing so with PERS, in essence, by having a higher contribution rate than other employers. Okay, great.
They agreed to that rate. It was specified, and they had an understanding. They had no written contractual agreement.
Representative,
that was my question.
No contractual agreement.
On this issue.
All right.
Payments started to be made, and that sort of triggered membership as far as some, you know, the district had made written inquiries and passed a resolution indicating a desire to join PERS, and this followed from that. But there was no integration agreement.
All right. Go ahead.
In the 80s, they started to see the writing on the wall, and that neighboring cities of Portland and Gresham were starting to annex significant portions of their district. And as they saw the erosion of their tax base, they decided they would contract with the city of Portland for fire protection. And they did that in July of 1984. by an intergovernmental agreement. The agreement did not talk about this unfunded liability was out there. The city of Portland agreed to take employees and the leases of equipment, and Portland began to pay the PERS premiums for these people. The district filed a notice of separation with PERS for each of these transferred employees, but PERS gets thousands of those type of notices every year as employees move around, and PERS was not notified of any new arrangement or contract between the city of Portland and the district, and the district and Portland did not sign a specific agreement on how to handle this situation. We have provided, with the help of Steve Delaney and Dale Orr at PERS, also a stack of documents for you that provide some type of audit trail as best can be assembled at this point in time on this issue that you have before you. And we'll have that to be made available to other parties. Those documents and other material were used to sort of sketch out the remaining part of this timeline. A couple of points before I conclude. In December of 85, an actuary evaluation was done at this date. PERS treated the district as sort of a subsidiary or a secondary employer of Portland. And the rate assigned to the city of Portland reflected this unfunded liability. Portland, in fact, was paying in their higher rate for the unfunded liability, even though they probably didn't know it. The money was going into Portland's account, but it wasn't used to credit this unfunded liability because PERS really didn't know about the relationship between the two. In December of 87, the reserves were negative for the first time in a figure of about $7 million for the district. A frustrating part of this is to see that there were no clear contractual arrangements as the parties went along. In 1988, for example, the fire district prevailed upon PERS to increase the benefits to some of their disabled retirees so that they would match what was being done in Portland's disability program without any clear understanding of what they really had contracted to. The situations were looked at almost on a case-by-case basis. In 1989, the employer reserves were included in the calculation for the city of Portland's contribution rate, even though the district's employer reserves were not included in the 1989 valuation. And they went back and forth on this. PERS had a problem knowing how to assign the rate and who it belonged to, and there's some anecdotal evidence on this and some audit trail. In 82, cities of Troutdale, Wood Village, and Fairview withdrew from the district, and at this time there was really no interaction between these cities and the district about the associated liability. In 1994, PERS and Milliman and Robertson were talking about this issue, and in 95, board members raised questions, and in 97, the problem made it to a list of items on PERS's strategic business plan that had become an agency priority to solve. In 97, PERS decided they would allocate the unfunded liability to Portland. They recently realized that that probably was not something that they could do, and presented a bill to the fire district for $76 million as a way to maybe trigger some a court action or a way to solve the problem and get a definitive ruling on it. And so here we are today. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
One question.
All right, question. Ms. Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mark, for all your hard work on this. What an amazing project. I have a question. You mentioned in 1984 the IGA, the Intergovernmental Agreement. There was no discussion of the first unfunded liability at any way through here.
Other matters were looked at, and other smaller matters were discussed, but this issue was never discussed. If it was discussed, it wasn't documented.
Any reason that you can figure why?
Only a psychological one, that I think the bigger the issue before bodies at times, I think people will say, of course this is taken care of. I mean, you can go to get a car loan, and that is documented and vetted. But, you know, you go to buy a $10 million building, and everyone thinks that somebody else will take care of the details.
Thank you.
All right. Representative Phillips Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You touched a little bit about the audits that were going on, and you were saying that Milliman and Robertson did an audit with PERS or with the fire district?
They were looking and inquired early on about what to do with this problem, and we have some documents in the packet that are from them and to them that talk about the discussion of that.
Follow up. Thank you. Were you aware of any audits that were performed by Fire District 10? In addressing the unfunded liability?
Representative Mona Sanderson, the only thing I remember was their asking an auditor, I think at Coopers and Lybrand, to look in and into it at some point.
And that was in the 80s or the 90s? 80s. Thank you.
All right. Mark, can you speak to the issue, or maybe someone else will have to speak to it, because in the timeline here, we've got a period of time in which Fire District 10 existed as a governmental organization, which was equal to or better than basically self-paying their retirement for their employees. And then they go into the PERS system. So they're paying the higher rate to compensate for the unfunded liability. And then there's this agreement that exists at some point to transfer employees, correct me if I'm wrong, but then somewhere in the midst of this entire discussion is a series of annexations that exist. And I'm reading through a letter from the city of Gresham, and one of the things that they mention is that at no time did they ever employ any of the former Fire District 10 employees, that these persons apparently went to the city of Portland. I guess what I'm trying to understand is, in this series of events, how does annexation play into the discussion? Annexation play into it. I don't know whether you have an answer or not, but it seems to me that when an annexation occurs, there's a transfer of employees, an existing statute that governs that, but apparently doesn't speak to the retirement issues, and that I don't know if the ball was dropped or if nobody talked about it or whether there are any documents that really give us insight as to whether the persons who were overseeing these transfers during the annexations even contemplated what might happen to this particular liability.
Yeah, Chair Minnis, that is the interesting question in this. Who was thinking about that, and who was following that? The liabilities historically have stayed with the districts. We have a listing of all the employees that were transferred and who they are and where they went, and they did go to Portland. The tax base is what historically has funded the retirement, though.
And I think if I can characterize this correctly, and again, correct me if I'm wrong, but over this period of time, the tax base has been eroded by annexations, and therefore, to the extent that there is a liability, the base is so much smaller that their capacity to pay is virtually non-existent. And then it also has something to do with bankruptcy and whether or not a municipal government can, in fact, go bankrupt. So can you speak to those issues?
Chairman, I think that the district today has a budget of about $1 million itself. It is in a position where they tried to increase by levy their revenue during the last election, and that was defeated. They, I believe, have one employee or a half of employee in a very small geographic area. I think that may be an issue that Mr. Hendricks can address, too, is public bodies and the options that are before you on okay. them.
But I think, in essence, the problem we have now is we have a Fire District 10 that does not have a geographic base or a tax base large enough to pay this bill regardless. They just simply couldn't do it. And that creates a huge problem. So now we have to figure out, hopefully, how to resolve that issue. Senator Metzger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mark, if you can answer this, or if not, maybe one of our other witnesses will be able to do that. Just following up on what the Chair was asking, and as you have these different municipalities, the Chair spoke about a letter that we received here today. It's about the City of Gresham-Wood Village and others been involved. And have commented that they do not have the employees. But is it not then accurate that the payment for those employees, i.e. the fire services, are paid out of the property tax base? Is that correct? And then, say for example, the City of Gresham or Wood Village or any other municipality, even the tax bases that are collected for that fire protection service within that municipality, are those taxes then sent to Portland to pay for those employees? Or where is the money that is supporting those employees? Whether they would be employed by those municipalities or not, is that tax money then transferred to that city? Because that is the support base. And in order to find ultimate payment, you're going to find out where the tax base is, because that's whether they're an employee or not. It's the money that is being paid for that service. If you wanted to trace back and actually what is sustaining protection services, and I just wondered how that works. If the City of Portland, for example, took the employees and they were providing services to an area, where does the money flow?
Senator Metzger, that is the other piece of solving this puzzle. The services that the unfunded liability was generated from was service prior to 1982 in that district. And depending on tax policy, revenues should pay for services in equitable taxation. But I think there's some others here that can talk to you about that, the district. Certainly the land was taken by the other entities that benefited from those services from up until 1982. And how that liability transfers, I think, is the important point to discuss.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that's going to be one issue that we need to figure out. It's going to be not just the issue of who the employee was, but where was the money generated to pay those employees, and because that will be the source of actually responsibility, I would say, ultimately, will be who had charge of that particular person.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Burdick.
Is part of the problem here, PERS is a funded system. It's not a pay-as-you-go system. That's correct. I know the Portland Fire and Disability Disability and Pension Fund is a pay-as-you-go system. Was this Fire District 10 a pay-as-you-go system?
Senator Burdick, they had contracted with Connecticut General, and some of their employees remained on that plan, and at some point Portland took over payment for some of that retirement. As far as the cash flows on the funding in the system, I think we'll have to let those much better than I talk to that.
That's probably part of the problem here is making the transition from a pay-as-you-go system to a funded system. That something got lost in the cracks. Am I understanding that correctly?
I think, Senator, you are, and I think that, in my mind, I'm trying to figure out how all of the certified smart lawyers representing the interested parties didn't think of that. Because one would assume that that's a huge elephant sitting in the middle of your living room, and that's an issue that assumedly you would have resolved. But by virtue of the fact that there is no clear trail, that is, as if it was never addressed, that it doesn't seem to appear anywhere, it was ignored, to me, ascribes at least some degree of malice or potential liability. Because you have a keen sense for the obvious, I have a keen sense for the obvious, certified smart lawyers do too. But sometimes they don't raise issues because they have other intents. That's my experience as a police officer.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Walker.
Didn't we hear yesterday from Jim Green in a conversation that this is not the only district that has this problem, however? So
that is true.
I think we have a lot of certified smart people that
seem to be ignoring the problem.
Yes.
And I think that begs the question then, if the statutes are not clear, and there is no guidance statutorily with respect to these transfers and what happens to the pension obligation, then maybe there ought to be. Maybe there ought to be clarity. And so, you know, without getting too pithy here and trying to, you know, ascribe blame to any particular party, I think the interest of the committee and the legislature would be to try to resolve the issue if we can. Other comments, questions, political diatribe? Okay? All right. Thank you very much. Jim, do you want to come up and talk about this first year? Jim and Steve and others, and this whole thing obviously pre-existed your work with BERS.
Chair, members of the committee, I'd be happy to make a few opening comments and then answer whatever questions I can. This is a complicated and, quite frankly, ugly situation.
Can you identify yourself, please?
I'm Jim Boyko. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Public Employees Retirement System. The opening comments are very brief, and there are 4 points. The first is, what is the issue here? The issue here is, what party is responsible for the pension liabilities generated by service provided by a group of employees that worked for Fire District 10 prior to any employee transfers, prior to any annexations? That's where the sum of money comes from. So the issue is, who's responsible for paying for the pension obligations earned by service provided by a group of employees that worked only for Fire District 10 during a specified period of time prior to any other changes? There are complications, which is why we're here, which is my second point. The core complication is as follows in our judgment. Fire District 10 and the various parties to whom they transferred employees via agreement or they transferred tax base via annexation never documented or wrote down the agreement among themselves about who was responsible for this set of obligations that were created prior to any of these transactions. And any type of transaction that occurs, and having spent 20 years in the private sector, you go through a set of due diligence that says who's responsible for what in excruciating detail. These were never written down. So this is a core complication, particularly for our agency, as we look at this to try to resolve what the parties believe they were transferring. Were they transferring this responsibility or not? The third, then there are two exacerbating circumstances. Exacerbation number one is that in many situations, and it's clear in Mr. Ellsworth's chronology to you, the agency found out about these transactions sometimes years afterwards. And that's probably not unusual, and it continues to this day. The fourth exacerbation is one that our agency is responsible for, and that is that the chronology clearly indicates that the agency vacillated from the early 1980s to very recent times.
Mr. Chair?
Senator.
When you say the agency, you're talking PERS.
I'm talking about PERS.
Thank you.
That PERS obviously vacillated about how to treat this peculiar situation. That has changed in recent years. We have a focused effort to resolve Fire District 10, and as the chair and I believe Senator Walker indicated, all related situations, we've launched an effort to address all of these, and in fact have successfully resolved several, in the process of. Fire District 10 happens to be the biggest, the longest standing, and the most complicated by a wide margin. But the reason I think that this is here before you today is that we're going back and trying to weed out these unresolved situations, and it is one of the reasons why we have presented a bill to Fire District 10, even though we're acutely aware of the inadequacy of their resources to pay it, because we know of no, it seems to us to be a necessary first step to whatever path of resolution lies before it. And our fiduciary responsibility requires us to seek the funds necessary to pay benefits that we are obligated to pay to members. So with that, I'll stop, and I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Right. Chairman. Senator Brady.
Would you even have the ability to kind of unwind the tape and go back to the tax base? The tax base now is quite a bit smaller to combat annexations and transfers and so on. But could you recreate the original tax base and bill all the affected parties where they are now?
Chair Minnis, Senator Burdick, I don't believe so without the assistance of a court order. And here, let me explain what I mean by that. In discussions with our attorneys and in our own deliberations, it is our understanding that we are limited to pursue obligations that have been created by service, limited to the employer that those services have been performed for, which is why we presented a bill to Fire District 10, because prior to 1982, that service was performed, as we understand it, solely for Fire District 10. So the law tells us we must go to the employer for whom the service was performed. We've thought ahead, though, in further answer to your question about what if they don't have the money, and there are a number of paths. One of those paths is to philosophically go along the lines I think that Chair Minnis was discussing, and that is ask the question, which citizens benefited from that service and where is the tax base represented by those citizens, and where I'm speculating now, but whether or not a court would, if PERS had exhausted all of its abilities to get funding from the responsible employer, which we are both obligated to do and authorized by statute, whether or not we could then, with the assistance of a court, address the obligation to the tax base in whatever jurisdiction it happened to lie in today. Was that responsive to your question?
That's responsive to the question. And I guess my next question is, is there some kind of subrogation process available that the Fire District 10 could go after the tax base where it is now?
Chair Minnis, Senator Burke, that's a question that's probably best addressed to their attorney. But one of the possible paths that we have speculated is that actions of some sort, either negotiations or legal actions between the parties who now own the tax base, are one possible path to resolution. Whether or not that could involve subrogation or something else is really that's beyond my legal understanding. I'm not an attorney.
Okay. And I think that really kind of underlies the problem. That is, to the extent that there's an absence of clarity in the statute in terms of authority, it gives rise to litigation, which means more years go by, which means the obligation gets larger, which means there's more uncertainty, which is, I think, the problem. So. Representative Anderson, did you?
Yeah, I have just some basic explanations on how these unfunded liabilities are paid. When you have an employee that transfers from one PERS entity to another PERS entity, how are the rates affected by those that had them previously and those after? When do you pay out? How does that affect the account once an employee retires? Can you give a little explanation on that, please?
Chair Minister, Representative Bonus Anderson, I'd be happy to. Let's take the simplest circumstance. One employee works for two employers during their career, two PERS employers. The first half of their career, they work for the state for 15 years, and the second half, they work for the city of Gresham for 15 years. And we would look at that as two what we call employment segments, completely distinct. Even though the employee sees it as one career, we see it as 15 years with the state, 15 years with the city of Gresham. That 15 years that was performed for the state is charged to the state and embedded in their rate. And the same for the 15 years for the city of Gresham. And that continues on after that employee retires once they move into what we call the benefits in force reserve, where we're actually paying money. Because remember, this is not a fixed obligation under a defined benefit system. If that employee happens to live to be 100, then we will be charging 15 years worth of those payments from retirement age through age 100 to the state, 15 years to the city of Gresham. And so the transfer itself doesn't move any obligations between employers whatsoever. And we know about that transfer only because we are required to get what's called a separation and then a notice of employment at the second employer, in this example, the city of Gresham. In these cases, these were transferred among employers under an agreement that was between the two parties that obviously in Mr. Ellsworth's presentation to you was not fully documented with respect to any special transfers about past pension liabilities. The documents appear to be silent about it. So we're left at a loss as to what the understanding of the parties were in the early 80s as to what they were getting and what they were receiving.
And just one other
question.
Oh, what happens now with people who go from a PERS to a non-PERS retirement? Still the same thing? They're still a part of that?
Chair Minnis, Representative Moniz Anderson, excellent question, because this is one of the processes that has actually created lots, and when I say lots, somewhere in the neighborhood of 50 tiny examples of Fire District 10. And what happens now, moving to a non-PERS public employer, is I believe from 1995 on, an employee has the right to stay in PERS, even in a non-PERS public employee, by statute, for 1 year. Which means that a non-participating public employer in PERS becomes a participating employer when they receive that employee for 1 year, and then they drop out. Once they drop out, they, however, have a long-standing obligation and open-ended to PERS for that employee. But at that point, when the person leaves PERS, when their year is up but they're still there, we have no payroll, no PERS payroll at that employer to charge the whatever amount is necessary to satisfy that person's obligation. And so we've got lots and lots of little examples of Fire District 10 that exist on the books. And we will address each one of those. Our effort in this area has been to take the larger, more complicated ones first. And when I say little, let me give you an example. Fire District 10, the last count, was $70 million. The next most largest, as of the September or as of the 2001 valuation, was only $38,000. So, if you wonder why we're addressing Fire District 10 first, I think it's kind of one of those duh questions.
On that point, can you identify kind of a cash flow analysis, or give me some sense for where we get this $76 million figure? And what that's based on. I understand that figure actually may be larger, but then there's also in the discussion some lump sum payment that I believe the city of Portland made, and I'm not clear as to what that payment was for and how that fit into this discussion, because if I understand correctly, that was assuming some of the unfunded liability. So can you help us understand that?
I'll do my best, Chair Minnis. The two questions relate to two sides of the pension ledger. Let's take the lump sum question last. The how the liability evolves over time, Service was performed by Fire District 10 employers up until 1980, employees up until 1982 for Fire District 10 alone. As I said, I believe in a letter to Representative Mona Sanderson, that obligation that's created is not a fixed amount. It's whatever it takes over time to pay the benefits that were generated, to pay the benefits that were earned. And as I say, if somebody lives 1 year after retirement, it may turn out to be a very small number. If they live to be 100, it could be a very large number. The actual liability is not known until the last employee that has performed service during that period for that employer dies, or their beneficiary dies.
Jim, I'm a little confused here. You have to help me understand this. Your costs and charges back to cities, counties, et cetera, is based on a set of assumptions, and embedded in those assumptions are issues like how long will the employees live? So, which is a theoretical approach, you know, that takes certified smart actuaries, et cetera, to try to figure out. But I guess in my mind, I'm thinking that they would have calculated most of those things, and so based on the rates that are being paid, that includes the things that you're now talking about, where how long does the employee actually live versus how long have we assumed that they would live based on our actuarial analysis. So,
Chairman, you're absolutely right. Even as early as the 1980s, the estimates are made and put into rates. But this is a case of what they call successive approximation. Eventually, the actual payments to employees need to be funded. And what the actuary does is that every 2 years, they reestimate and try to get closer and closer and closer. But the only ones that we know for sure can be retired as paid are when the employee dies or their beneficiary dies. One of the reasons why the obligation waxes and wanes is not only changes in estimates of longevity, which are one of them that has made the obligation bigger, because we know that our estimates of how long retirees are going to live has grown during the period of the Fire District 10 controversy. The other thing that has happened, of course, is money match, which I think this body is well aware of, earnings crediting, and more recently, poor investment returns. All of those things factor into what remains to be funded by the employer. And then, of course, we go back to what I said was the core issue, is who is the responsible employer to pay what remains. It would be possible, and we have some examples, many examples, where, in fact, we don't have an unfunded liability that remains to be paid, but there are some employers without a PERS payroll that actually have tiny surpluses, which we can't give back to them, at least we haven't figured out a good way yet, because we don't have a PERS rate that we can lower to amortize off their surplus. But as I said, these are tiny, and we will get to these, but we're taking the bigger, quite frankly, uglier situations first. We're not eating the ice cream or the icing on the cake before we...
All right. Talk to me about the $40 million payment by the City of Portland.
I apologize for not answering the second part of the question, Chairman. It's the lump sum that was paid by Portland. And again, I tried to address this in the letter to Representative Mona Sanderson. When an employer gets a set of obligations from us, it is detailed and bottoms up. But when they give money to us, it's not ascribed to any particular person or employee or any particular sub-obligation. So, for example, it's kind of like a consolidated debt payment. It may have come from many different sources, but City of Portland gave us some large lump sum of money. And it was against their liabilities, whatever those liabilities turned out to be. And, of course, their liabilities represent all the ones that they and PERS agree are theirs. And then there's the Fire District 10 liability, which is still uncertain at this point.
So the $40 million you're saying had really nothing to do with Fire District 10?
It simply built up Portland's assets generally to be applied to whatever obligations the city and PERS, the PERS board ascribes to the city.
All right. Senator Ringo and then Senator Walker.
Thank you.
One of the first things you said is that PERS had an obligation to the retirees, to the employees of the service division. I'm just wondering whether there's any uncertainty about that, whether because things are so murky, that obligation is somewhat unclear.
Chairman, Senator Ringo, that excellent question. But we have proceeded on the notion, and I think it's been relatively clear, that the system owes these employees the pension obligations that they've earned. Despite the funding controversy as to who is responsible, notwithstanding, there have been there have been no analyses that I'm aware of that have given us a legal basis, either generated internally in our staff or historically on the PERS staff or by attorneys that have said, we think you can just not pay these employees their pension obligations because there's a funding controversy about which employer is responsible for them. At least I'm not aware of any.
Right. Senator Walker, then Senator Farrelly.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I was looking at my notes yesterday from some conversation I had in my office, and I guess I'm unclear when Portland made that $40 million payment and the court later ruled that the assignment should be with Fire District 10 and not with Portland. Was that money refunded to Portland?
The answer is no, we've not refunded any money to Portland, and generally don't unless it is an amount that has been made in administrative error. Once monies come into the trust, they are held in trust for the sole benefit of paying benefits to members. And Portland's obligations, whatever, if any, they have with respect to Fire District 10, are very substantial, and as you know, the state is also considering giving us a lump sum. The school districts have given us lump sums. We would not return those dollars if they decided that their liabilities were less than they thought. These are monies once entrusted to us are to be faced off against the liabilities that would be associated with that particular employer. So I'm not aware of any refunds that we made.
Okay, Mr. Chair. So, Mr. Voitko, it sounds like PERS is like the Internal Revenue Service. Once you have it, you don't let it go?
Chair Minnis, Senator Walker, I guess that's sort of it. I would describe it to trust law and fiduciary law that unless a payment has been made in error, if it's been assigned to the lot to the trust fund, it doesn't go back. It is faced off against those liabilities, and I don't recall that anywhere in the documentation Portland's payment specified, nor would we ever ask it to, that at least in my experience, to a particular sub-liability that they may or may not have. It would be to meet their liabilities writ large.
So again, you're like the Internal Revenue Service. They apply it to the oldest liability. You can't really choose where your money goes when you pay your tax burden, and they just pay it to the oldest liability forward. And so I assume that's how PERS operates as well.
Chairman and Senator Walker, not exactly, but it's because all of the liabilities are current in the sense that we bring all liabilities down to what we call a current value of liabilities.
Okay.
So, but I think it is the same in the sense that an employer doesn't have a choice as to specifying which employees or subset of employees this particular payment or contribution is going to be applied to. The legislature has passed a statute in a recent special session that tells us that in lump sum payments that we're to create a separate account to ensure that those dollars go to the general liabilities of that employer and that employer only, again, but again, writ large, not specifically defined within their liability set.
Thank you. Senator Farrelly.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's along the same lines as Senator Walker's questions. I'd like to know, perhaps this will indicate that I haven't thoroughly studied my chronology. When was the $40 million payment made? I won't wait for that answer. I'll just go on and ask other questions. I have to assume that there were some coincident actions with that $40 million payment, that there was something that was of a predicate nature. I mean, they wouldn't simply just wake up one day inspired to drop $40 million in PERS. So I'd like to know what the connection was in the chronology between the payment of $40 million and what other actions were coincidence or what predicated the payment. And, relative to that issue, I mean, I don't know if that will help us discern what was in the minds of the people that authorized the $40 million payment, but something must have triggered it. And I wonder if it's evident in the chronology.
Chairman and Senator Farioli, perhaps we can answer that question in depth. First of all, I won't be much help. I wasn't here in 1999. And I have not seen any documentation that says, here's what was in our minds when we did this. That's specific to Fire District 10.
Mr. Chairman, I just need to know also if there's any... is there a pattern of additional payments made by the jurisdiction in the PERS? I mean, something triggered this. Was it anomaly? Was it a predicate on something? Was there at least an assumption that there was value given for value received?
Not that I'm aware of, but as again, in answering your question in depth, we have people here, both from the affected parties and from my staff, who were here, and they can at least tell you anything in their recollection, and maybe they're aware of documentation that I'm not aware of.
I'm just wondering if the question's not better addressed to the parties, in particularly the city of Portland, and what was in their mind, because I think, if I understand correctly, you're saying that when there are lump sum payments, it's applied to the macro of all of the employees and all the obligations of a particular municipality and not Fire District 10, and that's your understanding of what your obligations are under the law. Portland may have had a different understanding or intent with respect to that payment. So the choice the legislature may very well have is to say, okay, if the intent was to pay the unfunded liability at that time, that legislatively we would direct you to credit it to that account and also ascribe any interest that might have accrued thereto, et cetera, against the obligation. We can do that legislatively if that was the understanding that the city had. Now, if the city of Portland had a different understanding or had a different intent, then maybe they wouldn't support that because maybe they have another obligation that now becomes present if you ascribe it only to Fire District 10. So.
And indeed, Chair Minnis, the third layer in depth of answer to Senator Farioli's question is to ask the parties themselves who made the payment. But we can't speak for them.
All right. Thank you. Did you any comments you want to make? Or?
Senator Minnis, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dale Orr, Fiscal Services Division Administrator for PERS. In answer to your question specifically, at least from the PERS perspective, what triggered this particular payment, or at least the $40 million, is that we did the 1997 valuation, which is the basis for changing or applying employer rates. There was an increase in the employer rate as a result of that particular evaluation. And City of Portland requested us to go through in detail as to what that rate increase was. A portion of that was, is in 1997, we included $40 million in that particular during the 97
valuation,
we put it in there, and that became identified to the City of Portland.
All right.
And therefore their unfunded actuarial liability from a PERS perspective.
So in 1997, when you did the valuation, you then had that $40 million present.
Right.
So it was standing out like a pink elephant.
We identified it as a subset of their general liability, but actually they did not convey $40 million to us in 1999. They conveyed over $100 million.
Yes. Yes, it was.
As an app, and again, as I said before, we applied that much larger sum against their total obligations.
I see.
And to my knowledge, there was no documentation from Portland that said 40 million of that 100 plus million is to be ascribed to this particular liability.
Mr. Chairman, follow up. Was it about the same time? And again, I apologize for not having studied my chronology. Was it about the same time that the jurisdictions became aware of the Fire District 10 issue?
I think it was about...
It reasonably have been assumed that one of the cost drivers was the Fire District 10 issue at that point.
Chairman, Senator Farioli, that particular event was really the notification to the cities in East County, Gresham, Troutdale, so on and so forth, occurred in
1998, I believe.
Yes,
so it was a year prior to that.
It was just about the same time. It was just prior to that.
I believe the East cities were notified by PERS in the chronology that they might be liable for some part of Fire District 10's liability in 1998. Is that correct?
No, 1999.
March 1999.
Okay, but my chronology, can I interject?
Absolutely, Senator. You can strike a light.
My chronology says that that PERS unilaterally allocates the District 10 prior service unfunded liability to Portland,
right.
And the unfunded liability is approximately $40 million. That was in 1997. So they allocate it, and then
they
paid it. 2 years later, Portland makes this big lump payment. How can you not assume that part of that payment was for this? I don't understand.
Senator Burdick, we try not to assume. That's why one of the lessons, I think, from Fire District 10 is write things down, if there's any lesson in it whatsoever.
I'll give you a pass.
And, again, we have gotten lump sums from huge numbers of school districts now. We're discussing it with the state. The state is discussing it with you. We've received them from a number of municipalities, and in no lump sum that I'm aware of has some subset of their liabilities been identified as the target or the reason for the payment. Is that correct, Dale?
Right.
It's always, we owe you this much money, and it comes from all these employees and all these other things, so we're going to give you a lump sum to try to reduce our rate. So it would be quite out of the ordinary for a lump sum employer who gave us a lump sum to specify a subset, and I'm not sure that we would be able to record keep a specific liability as having been paid, particularly because, as I said earlier, these liabilities are never known with certainty and therefore can't be declared paid until the last employee or their beneficiary dies.
Is this embedded in that blizzard of notifications that went out to all the jurisdictions about their level of unfunded liability, or did this happen before then?
This happened before, didn't it?
Yes. Senator Burdick, Senator Farioli, there were other things going on in the system during this time. We had a significant rate increase as a result of the 1997 valuation. And so there was a lot of notifications going out to the employers at that time that their rates were going up, coincidentally with this particular issue.
Yeah, I heard about that.
Yes. So in the context of us discussing these, we were talking with many employers regarding their rate increases related to 1997. Mm-hmm. Keep in mind, this is late in 1998 that we were actually having these discussions. And City of Portland was one that wanted to have a sit-down meeting with us concerning their rate increase. At that time, that's when we identified the $40 million that was a part of their unfunded actuarial liability. When they later came to make their payment, they recognized that they were paying off their entire unfunded actuarial liability, which included that $40 million. But they made it very clear to us at that time, maybe not in writing, but they did make it clear to us that if those liabilities were to be found not to be part of the City of Portland, then therefore they would expect those liabilities to be removed from the unfunded liability related to the City of Portland.
Thank you.
Other questions? Senator Metzger.
Guess I'll look at the print.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator Burdick. Jim, just for the record, I want to have you be very clear about this. We've been talking about this actuarial liability, which is a moving target, but the liability that is assumed now for Fire District 10 employees and the dollar figure, if this can be totally validated. I mean, if you had an independent auditing firm came in, Deloitte & Touche was be retained at your expense, you know, to look at this, you can, A, number one, validate the liability without question, and number two, that the paper trail of who is liable for that, that an independent auditing firm would be able to validate your assumption on who's liable for that also. That's why I want to know that answer.
Senator Metzger, I'll have to answer the first one in the affirmative. I don't know that any party has taken issue with the calculations of what the obligations are to Fire District 10 employees, at least to my knowledge. Everybody has stipulated that the numbers are right. So I believe that if we brought another actuarial firm in or an accounting firm, they would say you followed the right practices in estimating, because until the last person dies, it's always an estimate. You followed the right purposes. In fact, we had our practices for our auditor, for our actuary, audited by an auditing actuary firm just a few years ago, and they got a clean bill of health. So I can answer affirmatively to the first question. To the second question, would there be a clear paper trail of documentation as to what the parties agreed to in terms of who was responsible for this liability? I doubt that very much, because we've not been able to find a clear paper trail.
Obviously one of our major problems. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Any other questions, please? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You know, Madam Chair, we might just make a political comment.
Yes, a diatribe.
Yeah, everyone laughs at me because I take so many darn notes, but seems to me some of these districts out here need to take some lessons from that.
I think would it be helpful to hear from City of Portland? I think it would be helpful.
She didn't say that. Leslie Roberts is here.
District 10.
Oh, okay.
District 10. Why don't we bring up District 10, City of Portland, and City of Gresham? Do we have room for anybody?
I'm here for District 10.
Yeah, come on up. Why don't we hear from District 10 first?
Okay. I'm Leslie Robertson, attorney for District 10, and I was actually present at most of the transactions that we've been talking about, including the time when District 10 integrated with PERS in 1982 and the contract with the City of Portland in 1984. It's been interesting listening to others talk about things that occurred, because in many cases, in details which may or may not be significant to you, I think that the inferences that have been drawn by those who had no part in those transactions have been different from what I would say occurred based on what I experienced and what was said at the time, what was going on at the time. I'm sorry that Senator Minnis has stepped out, because I would like to respond to the comment that he made about the elephant that was ignored. I don't think that it was ignored. There is a provision of the contract that we had with the City of Portland, which provided explicitly that any and all claims, whether arising before or after the execution of this agreement, being the contract with the City of Portland, Senator Minnis, I'm Leslie Roberts. I wanted to speak about the contract that the district formed with the City of Portland at the time I was representing the district, and in that contract it provided that any and all claims, whether arising before or after the execution of this agreement, on account of, by, or on behalf of any employee or employees transferred to the city's employment pursuant to this contract, if any such claims is asserted against the district after the execution of this agreement, that the city of Portland would indemnify the district for any of those claims. And as I would read that provision of the contract, that would certainly include the claims that we're talking about here. Now, why is it that we can't simply then sue the city of Portland over a claim asserted by against us on behalf of or on account of the employees that were transferred to the city? Well, that's because we had no idea of any of this obligation. When we signed a settlement agreement with the city, we litigated with the city over unrelated areas of this contract after it came to an end. And in the course of that settlement agreement, as in the course of most settlements agreement, both sides agreed that they would not sue each other again over any aspect of that contract. It was a couple of years later that we were first advised of PERS after 20 years that there was any unpaid amounts on account of the employees that had been transferred. Consequently, we had an explicit agreement with the city of Portland that all responsibilities on account of any of the transferred employees would be assumed and would be borne by the city, and that they would save us harmless. And we are completely incapable, because of the fact that PERS kept us totally in the dark, to enforce that agreement. Now,
can I just interject here? Would that have been even legal, the transfer of responsibility for liabilities that arose before there was any relationship between the city of Portland and its employees?
Yes, Your Honor. I'm sorry. I'm more accustomed to appearing in court than in this body. Yes, Senator Burdick, it would have been legal under Chapter 190 of the Oregon Code. There's almost unrestricted flexibility of intergovernmental agreements. And the basic agreement with Portland was one allowed and provided for under that section, which allowed for two governmental entities to blend an operating agency. And the impact of the formation of the Portland contract was to create a single merged fire department, which would be the Portland Department. And it would assume all obligations with regard to operations that Fire District 10 had previously provided. And under the terms of Chapter 190, we are allowed to assign liabilities. Two entities can assign liabilities as they choose, and they had done so. And furthermore, this tracked statute. When we had integrated with PERS in 1982, the tide of annexations had already started, and there was a great deal of concern on the board about adopting an obligation which would go into the future when its tax base was visibly being eroded and was... Everyone knew what was coming, that the district would be diminished to almost nothing. And we actually assumed that the district would go out like a candle extinguished.
Ms. Roberts, let me interject something in this discussion, too. And I think it's important to know that along this time, the Environmental Quality Commission has mandated that the Mid-Multnomah County area install sewers, because when I first came to the legislature, most of that area was on sewer. So you had the environmental quality, right, the septic system, et cetera. And so the EQC makes the mandate, and now you have an aggressive annexation that occurs partly because Portland has the infrastructure to do the sewering, et cetera. I believe at some point there was a successful lawsuit against the city of Portland dealing with annexations and whether or not you can compel annexations based on providing services like sewers, et cetera, blah, blah, blah. But the background is such that there was a very aggressive movement on the part of both the city of Portland, and I think to some degree Gresham also engaged in that same aggressive movement. And the other underlying part of this was Portland had previously annexed out to 185th in the Columbia South Shore area, which is most of a commercial industrial base, and then also had drilled and established a well system as a backup to the Bull Run system that existed there. So you had a background of EQC's mandate of sewering and aggressive annexation, at least initially by Portland, which swallowed up most of the industrial base, and I think Gresham and other municipalities looking at where their future is going to ultimately be, and so the annexations were moving along, you know, pretty stridently. So there's a history behind all of this. It's not just Fire District 10.
No, that's absolutely true, Senator Minnis. This has to be seen in a context in which that was what was happening. And what Fire District 10 was trying to do was struggle to make an arrangement that would both ensure a continuity of service to the people that they had served for so long and also provide stability and safety to 200 employees, for which they also felt responsible.
There were also transfers of Portland or sheriff's deputies from the sheriff's department at this time, but I believe they...
That was before that.
ERS, right?
That happened just before us, and that was something of a... That was a model of how it was going to go.
But I raised that issue because I think those deputies were already in PERS. They were not in the Equal to or Better Than program, which I think exacerbated this problem. So.
Yeah. And, of course, our employees were in PERS, but had only been there for 2 years. I want to make a point. Senator Burdick mentioned the difference between a pay-as-you-go system and a funded system, and I think that may play in a little into the story, because the Connecticut General, the private system, was largely pay-as-you-go, although partially funded. The district had about $5 million in reserves, which was then paid into PERS as part of the integration. There was a kind of an integration agreement. It was District 10 adopted the documents that PERS gave them. The resolution was drafted by PERS. If PERS had said, here's a contract, they would have signed the contract as well. But the resolution states the terms of the integration. And we did actually have a little bit of litigation about that a few years later when PERS decided not to give the cost of living increases to retirees that the integration agreement had provided. And we litigated that, and PERS agreed that they were wrong and changed. So that had been regarded as the integration agreement. The integration agreement imposed liabilities for payments on District 10. But of course there was no obligation to PERS by District 10 prior to 1982, because we had no relationship with PERS prior to 1982. The obligations of the district to PERS dated from 1982, and those were obligations to make payments according to a rate that had been presented to us as being the rate at which they would give us the pension benefits we wanted. And I'm sure that our board assumed, and I had no expertise in pension law, that it was a little like buying an insurance policy. You picked the benefits you wanted and you paid the rate they imposed upon you. So it was not thought of as being any... No one talked about some past obligation. It was an obligation that dated from that time, and we paid it from 1982 to 1984, at which point the agreement with Portland obliged them to pick up all liabilities on behalf of employees, and we, for all the District 10 knew and believed, and certainly did believe, that Portland was continuing the payments which we otherwise would have made.
Senator Ringo.
I'm sure it's in this chronology somewhere, but could you summarize that agreement? What was the nature of that agreement?
Which agreement?
Well, the 1984 agreement where you say Portland agreed to accept all liabilities.
In 1994, we entered into...
1984?
1984. Okay. 1984, we entered into an agreement with Portland, whereby Portland assumed all of the obligations of the district and all of the employees of the district and the personal property of the district.
And is this an agreement in writing?
Yes, it
okay.
is an
and
agreement.
Somewhere in this packet?
I don't believe it is in that packet.
I
can certainly provide it.
I want to see if, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, we do have Mark put in our packet. I want to make sure and see if we do have it.
Oh, you do have it. Yes,
okay.
That's right.
What's it labeled?
The resolution?
Contract. It's in the back.
Oh.
Contract between our EDN and 84-90.
It's the second green sheet from the bottom.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, and Senator Ringo, I believe you may have been out of the room when I mentioned at the outset that it provides an indemnification for all claims on or behalf or on account of any employees that are transferred, regardless of whether the claim arises before the execution of the agreement or during the execution of the agreement.
Can I interrupt, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee? Are you referring to Article 11 of the agreement when you talk about the indemnification for employee claims? Do you need to look at this?
I need to look at that to tell you which article it is. Yes, I am referring to Article 11.
Okay. All right. Senator Walker, did you have a question?
Yeah, I did. It's very quick. I just wanted to make sure I understood. When you signed up with PERS in 1982 and then you signed this contract with Portland in 84. Did the district make payments under its
PERS obligation
made payments those 2 years?
For those 2 years.
Okay. Okay, I wanted to make
sure.
Yes,
they did.
So you knew you had an obligation that was ongoing.
Well, of course we knew we had an obligation that was ongoing, but of course PERS simply told us what our rate was. We were given the option of integrating at various different rates and obtaining different benefits, and the benefit that the board elected to obtain was the best benefit for its employees.
Right, and then
and that was at a rate of about 25% of payroll.
Okay, and then you assumed when you've been making the payments for 2 years, and then you assumed when you signed this contract with Portland that under Article 11, Portland was taking up the rest of those payments.
Yes,
on an ongoing basis.
Without doubt. And furthermore, when we made the decision to integrate with PERS, PERS representative came to a couple of board meetings to talk about the benefits of integrating with PERS and also to receive questions from the board. The board was concerned about what was going to happen with its tax base eroding and asked PERS what would the future bring if the tide of annexations continued with withdrawals from the district and decreased ability to pay. And what the PERS representative did at that time was to tell the board, essentially, don't worry, because the statutes provide for this circumstance. And what he was pointing to is still exists in the statute, which was ORS 236.620, which provides what happens to an employer, to a public employee when the duties of that employee are displaced or taken over by a different public employer. That, of course, was precisely what would happen in terms of annexation, and it's also what happened under the terms of the Portland contract, because Portland took over the functions that those employees had handled as employees of Fire District 10. And what that statute says is, among other things, that the employee can transfer, and when it does, the receiving employer shall make contributions. I'm talking about contributions to the pension system. The receiving employer, Portland in this case, shall make contributions on behalf of the employee to the system as required of employers participating in that system, as if the transfer had not occurred. So we were basically being told by PERS that if annexations displaced our employees or their jobs were taken over by other public employers, they could transfer, and that the receiving employer would make the same payments that we would have made had that transfer never occurred.
All right, hang on one second. I want to have you kind of put like a traffic cop here for just a second. Senator Walker.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. That's very interesting, what you just told me on the committee. When PERS told you that, did they come to your board and tell you that? Did they tell you that as the attorney for the board?
They came to the...
Hold on just one second. If they told that to the board, then it seems to me you have minutes of those board meetings. Do you have minutes that reflect that conversation by PERS with the board? Do we have copies of those?
I'll provide them to you.
Okay. Senator Metzger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You made a statement earlier. I'm trying to get through a chronology here, and I think you were speaking of generic time frames, but you made the comment it was almost 20 years later before we knew that there was a potential unfunded liability. Well, that would be, 2002. Probably didn't mean that.
Well, no.
So when was the first time that Fire District 10 had knowledge that there may be an unfunded liability attributed to Fire District 10?
1997. When I looked at the chronology that Mark made, I was startled that he made a reference to some earlier statement by the Tax Conservation and Advisory Committee about an unfunded liability, and that's confusing. There was no statement about the PERS problem. And there was no audit by Coopers and Liband about the PERS problem. You have to remember that we had people who had retired before the integration with PERS that were under the Connecticut General Program. And the Connecticut General Program was, as I said before, partially funded but largely pay-as-you-go, because the benefits in the Connecticut General Fund program were almost inherently unpredictable. They were 60% of whatever top firefighters' pay was at the time the benefits are paid, so that any time you had a negotiation with the employees and you increased wages today, simultaneously you would be increasing all of your pension payments for those who had retired in previous years. So that was an obligation that District 10 had and has to the Connecticut General retirees, which they knew about, and it was a note on our audits. And that was the matter that the Tax Supervisory Committee had a concern with. No one knew about this until 1997, when I received a telephone call from Dale Orr.
Okay, that's fine. That's what I wanted to know. That's a follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Sure.
Okay, so I'm in 1992 now, prior to this time, when Wood Village and Cowtown and other municipalities withdrew from Oklahoma County Fire District 10, formed their own tax base. So, we had the Portland situation 10 years earlier. Now this hasn't happened. Was there A, both understandings, and B, is there documentation that discussed, the same issues with what those municipalities were assuming in terms of liabilities? Had there been any, quote, lessons learned between that period of time, or is there any documentation as to what Fire District 10's obligations would be or what those municipalities' obligations would be having withdrawn and then assuming a new tax base themselves?
Well, the withdrawal of the three cities was done through a quasi-judicial process before the then Metropolitan Boundary Commission, and the remarks of all sides are fully documented. Fire District 10 complained to the Boundary Commission about the impact that would have on its ability to pay the pension to the Connecticut General retirees, because that was the only thing that they knew about at that time. that concern was not one which moved the Metropolitan Boundary Commission, nor did it apparently move the three cities. Subsequently, we wrote to the three cities and we suggested that they had some obligation to help us with the Connecticut General retirees, and they did not respond to that request. The statutes with regard to the obligations of a municipality that withdraws tax base from a special district such as ours provide very limited relief to the district. They provide that the withdrawing municipality has an obligation for a proportional share. What it boils down to is a proportional share of the bonded indebtedness of the district. These are not bonded obligations.
So there was no discussions or paper trail regarding, at this time, any potential pension liability assessment for that particular tax basis that were being withdrawn.
Well, there was no paper trail. There was nothing to lay down a trail. There was no agreement.
Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Ringo.
I just want to go back to the question I asked you earlier about, and you said in 94 Portland agreed to take on the liability.
1984.
84, I'm sorry.
I made the same mistake.
84,
really.
And you're pointing to this contract between the Fire District Number 10 and the City of Portland. And mm-hmm. is the only place in the contract that you're relying on, is that the Article 11?
Well, Article 11 is, to me, sweeps up everything else. Otherwise, the contract provides that the transferred employees shall have all the benefits of the seniority that they had with the district, and that the compensation would be carried on by the City of Portland, commensurate with the positions they received and those positions.
That doesn't speak to picking up the obligation or time obligation.
I want to interject something here, because I have some history in this building and worked on legislation dealing with annexation issues in the first of my district. The underlying assumption was, and I think exists in statute, that you really are not, by virtue of annexation, to disrupt the benefits or the employment of pre-existing public employees. So you have an annexation that sometimes is a hostile annexation, or it occurs by virtue of vote, or there are island annexations and all kinds of methodologies for getting from point A to point B. So I think the underlying assumption is the employees continue in their employment and are subsequently transferred without harm to their rights and or privileges as an employee, et cetera. And I know we had there was some discussion about whether you transfer to the City of Portland, whose wages were higher, or you transfer to the City of Gresham, and I think the courts ultimately said it didn't make any difference. You transfer one or the other, and your rights as an employer are preserved. But you know, I'm reading through the contract. If you look at subsection 3 of Article 7, it says all district employees transferred effective July 1, 1984 shall be eligible to participate in the State of Oregon Public Employees Retirement System PERS program for the city. Then it goes on to say all sworn personnel continuing on PERS will be responsible for contributing the employee share to the system unless otherwise stipulated by the Portland City Council. And I think if you read that, although it doesn't say whose obligation it is, I think the underlying assumption is, again, that there's no displacement, that these persons are transferring and being taken over, that obligation assumedly follows. It specifically says that the employees have to pay their share unless otherwise stipulated. But again, I'm saying that my recollection, my understanding of these things is that for the most part, the assumption was that you're going to annex them, you're going to have to take our employees, and you cannot disrupt their retirement benefits.
Mr. Chair, just to respond, that's what I was trying to figure out is if we're saying that in 84, Portland accepted the liability, the retirement liability, I'd like to know exactly what the source of was. What was the exact mechanism of assuming that liability? And the witness referred to Article 11. I mean, Article 11, you're right, it's pretty broad, but on the other hand, it doesn't even mention retirement obligations. And so then, not in that article. And so then the chair pointed out this subsection 3 of Article 7, I think it is.
Right.
And maybe it is implied there, or maybe it's implied in the annexation. But I just don't see it clear in this contract.
Well, Senator Ringo, Senator Menace, I believe Senator Minnis is completely correct. That was the understanding. That certainly was the intent of the statute I mentioned to you, and within the frame of the contract, the sort of the dragnet language of Article 11, any and all claims, is intended to mean anything we haven't expressed directly.
Actually, Senator, I want to kind of interject something else here because that's some fun part of being a chair. I kind of want to get to the city of Portland at some point here and talk to them about the $40 million, because it seems to me that's a pretty critical part of the discussion. Because even though PERS credited it to the entire municipality and their obligation, I have a sneaking suspicion that there might have been some other underlying thinking that was going on. I cut you off, so I don't feel.
Well, I was just going to say, I just really disagree with that interpretation of Article 11. I mean, it says I think if it was intended to address some sort of a retirement obligation, it would have been included. And I think this has to do with employment claims.
Senator Ringo, Senator Minnis, I know you want to move to Portland. I only want to say that there was no. At the time of this contract, there was no $15 million, $70 million, any huge liability. There were simply ongoing premiums that we were paying. We were transferring the employees. They were paying ongoing premiums for retirement. They were paying ongoing premiums for health insurance. They were paying all sorts of ongoing premiums.
Well,
there is no question
that.
In the world.
I just don't think that language in Article 11 brings that in.
Yeah.
That's all.
And Charlie, you may be absolutely right. I think one of the other points is that, help me understand this, there was a period of time you're not in PERS, you're equal to or better than, then you become PERS. And then there's an ascribed rate that was 25%, is that correct?
25%.
25%, which I assume was much higher than other employers in Portland.
Yes, it definitely was. It
and
was
the
higher
assumption
because
there was that the district is now picking up that future obligation. Then the transfer occurs, and the transfer payments to PERS. So I, somewhere along the line, it seems that would have followed through. Senator Brady.
I just had a detailed question, and before we go too much farther, I'll declare this before we vote as well, but I do have a potential conflict of interest because I am a citizen trustee on the Fire and Police Pension Disability Board in the City of Portland.
Aren't you a volunteer?
I'm a volunteer, but that's okay. But I did have just a detailed question as to why these employees continue with PERS instead of being wrapped up into the Fire and Police Pension Disability Board. I mean, I'm assuming
Article 7, Section 3 addresses that issue, too, and says that they can go into the Portland Police Fire Disability System so long as they meet a certain medical evaluation test. So that was an option available to the employee.
Is that on an employee-by-employee basis?
It was on an employee-by-employee basis. Much of the employer-employee stuff in the contract was negotiated directly by the union attorney and the labor attorneys for the City of Portland. My understanding, being on the periphery of those, was that there were some individual calculations. One way it might cut somewhat better depending upon a particular employee's longevity, how far they were from retirement. So that was something that could benefit some employees one way or some of the other.
Because I'm a participant in that system, but I think, and Portland, you can help me, that this was before the pension reform in Portland, correct?
Mm-hmm.
So I think at that time, the underlying assumption of the Portland Police Fire Pension System is that the disability program existing in the Portland program was much better than what existed in PERS, because I think you were, for the most part, in PERS under the workers' compensation system, and this was outside, separate. So from a public employee's perspective, and working particularly in police and fire jobs, the disability component was significant. So that's, I think, why that was an option.
I would like to hear from Portland.
All right. Are we ready to transition?
Yeah.
Sir.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for letting me speak today. My name is Steve Manton. I work for the City of Portland Office of Management and Finance. I'm not going to go over the history of this per se, but I'd like to point out just a few key issues that came up here through the time. First was, of course, in 1982, Multnomah County Fire District 10 joins PERS, and they brought in an unfunded liability at that time, which PERS has around $14 million. And that was for work performed prior to their joining PERS. So this is clearly before 1982. In 1984, we, the City of Portland and Multnomah County Fire District 10, entered into a contract, and we accepted the employees from Fire District 10, and we started paying for all of their PERS costs that were incurred from that date forward. We were billed by PERS for those, and in fact, at that point, we had no fire employees that were PERS members. So, is it, you know, for PERS, they have a different police and fire rate, and they have to go back in and calculate one of each. So there's a real clear differential between the City of Portland. We have 3,800 general service members. We currently have about 86 police and fire members. As the District 10 members have started to retire, and as the Multnomah County Sheriffs that came over also started to retire. So PERS clearly had to see that there was suddenly this group of people that had not been there before. There was a new rate that they had to create and combine with our other rate and then give us a single rate that we pay to PERS each year. But we did pay for all of their PERS service starting in 1984 when we took on those employees from District 10. PERS did not bill any jurisdiction for this unfunded liability that was created prior to 1982 for at least 13 years. We finally were billed for that, the City of Portland, in 1997 valuation. We got the bill in 1998. 1998, our bill from PERS came in, and our rates went from 9.89% of payroll to 17.4% of payroll. And that was the event that the chair had asked about, what drove us to go back in and find out what this cost was and what was driving it. So we'd asked PERS to come and give us a detailed accounting of what it was in our bill, and that's when we did find out about Fire District 10 unfunded liability. We had no knowledge of this for the whole time, actually, from our inception of our contract with Fire District 10 until PERS presented that bill to the city. Within a year, the city decided that what we needed to do was to pay off our unfunded liability. Our unfunded liability, here's a real quick one. In 1991, the city's unfunded liability was $2 million. In 1997, 6 years later, our unfunded liability was $257 million. So this is why we decided to pay it off, because PERS also charged 8% interest on your bill, and that ratcheted up very quickly. We went out in the markets, determined that we could sell bonds for substantially less than the 8%. We could pay it off, and we could arbitrage that amount between the 8% and whatever our interest payments were for the $257 million that we did pay off. So that's why we went and we took the money to PERS and we said, look, here we're going to pay off our unfunded liability, but we do not assume that the Fire District 10 liability is ours. We dispute that particular piece of our liability that you have presented to us.
Thank you, Chairman.
Senator Brady.
Was that in writing?
No, it wasn't. Neither side put it down, but we had continuous conversations with them because we had a couple other issues that we were dealing with.
Continuing conversations with PERS.
With PERS, yes.
Sorry, okay.
Then the final piece here is that in the year 2002, the Attorney General, while PERS was crafting a rule.
I want to ask you a question, though, before you get in there. With this $257 million that the city paid for their unfunded liability, even though you say we did not assume or accept the liability for the pre-existing obligation, was that included in the $257 million?
Senator Minnis, yes, that was. The PERS had detailed that was part of that.
So you paid it in anyway, even though you didn't assume it.
Senator Minnis, as I said, it was a financial decision, totally. It was cheaper long-term to pay it off. Our rates dropped substantially just because of the 1.5%.
Right, the point I'm trying to make is in the $257 million, even though you're saying we don't accept this and we dispute it or whatever the right terms might be, there was money ascribed to that debt that you were disputing, which was how much money?
Approximately $40 million.
Approximately $40 million. So notwithstanding your dispute over this, the $40 million is in that figure. Correct.
Yes, Senator Minnis, that's true.
Senator Walker.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. But, sir, when you made the payment, you didn't state in writing that this $257 million that we're paying to you includes the $40 million that we dispute that we owe on Fire District 10 unfunded liability.
Senator Walker, Chair Menace, no, it was not in writing.
So they sent you a bill for it, you paid it, mean, he didn't document the dispute. Okay, Senator Ferriola.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, that notwithstanding assertions that $40 million is for a particular liability, the agency has testified it has no authority to segregate debt in that way.
Right. But my point is, and I want to, as you said on the record, that you're disputing that particular obligation, but you paid it anyway. That's getting to the point that even you paid it, and I think you didn't protest it, you didn't write it down on any document, and I think there's an assumption of risk, an assumption of liability.
Mr. Chairman, I didn't hear that. I didn't hear that they paid it. I heard that you paid $100 million toward the $250 million.
No, Senator Burdick, we paid $257 million.
Oh, okay, so you paid the whole.
And embedded in that was that $40 million figure, even though they disagreed that that was their obligation.
So if you had disagreed about that and then you had prevailed, then that would have shown up in the future as a lower rate.
Senator Burdick, yes, that's true. One point. We contested this. We actually contested the initial rate that PERS sent to us for their 1997 valuation. And in fact, that contesting of that rate became the basis, along with Eugene and Lane County and Multnomah County contesting their rates, became the basis for the lawsuit that went forward to Judge Lipscomb. And eventually, Judge Lipscomb found in our favor this past October, and that's the basis for the legislation that's come through in this session in terms of PERS reform. So it was all a part of a package as we went forward on this.
Right.
The final piece I wanted to say was in 2002, as PERS started to put together a rule to figure out how to deal with any of these issues that came forward, and Harney County had an issue similar to this, the Attorney General looked at the actual issue that had taken place here and came back with an opinion that stated that PERS did not have the authority under statute to transfer liability from one employer to another. After the Attorney General stated that, we wrote a letter to PERS Board and requested that they credit our account with the money that we had paid them, and they did that. So our account has been credited for that $40 million. We haven't received any money.
In saying that, what does that mean? They left the money in a system, but then they credited it towards employees.
Towards future liabilities of Portland employees.
Okay. All right. I think I understand.
Yes.
Did that change your rates, by the way?
Essentially, I don't know, because it wrapped up with all of the work that the actuary did with the new legislation.
But did you have them run assumptions based on whether it was or wasn't?
It was rolled into the whole package. I never saw any, and they did not run it for us specifically.
You didn't have computer runs that said if it's not assumed, then it's X, and if it is assumed, it is Y.
Senator Dennis Nome didn't.
All right, so you just flat don't know that answer. Okay.
Yeah. What I'd finally like to say here is that...
Who was the Attorney General at the time, by the way?
Hardy Myers.
Hardy was?
Yes, sir. The attorney was Bob Muir, who wrote the opinion, I believe.
All right.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, as you can see, the greatest cause of the problem here, truthfully, is PERS. PERS didn't bill anybody for a long time. District 10 didn't know about this. Gresham didn't know about this. City of Portland didn't know about this. It suddenly just showed up one day, and it was 13 years after the fact. These are the folks who, through inaction, through never telling anybody where it was going to, I mean, they sent us a bill every year. We paid our bills every month with the rate that they gave us, assuming that everything had been taken care of. And that's pretty much what District 10 had the same issues with them. They paid every bill that was sent to them. They assumed everything had been taken care of. Here we are 13 years later, this bill comes due. Nobody's seen it at any time in any of those years. So through their inaction, and then through their constitutional inactions in terms of transferring liability where they were not able to do it, they've created this problem. And for that reason, we feel that the strongest issue here is that PERS needs to assume a bunch of the responsibility for this, and that PERS should look into their own contingency funds, which the legislature has set up and has directed them to fund for over 20 years now, and find the funds in the contingency fund out of future interest payments and cover this unfunded liability for all the parties. Thank you very much.
Okay, Senator Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sir, I have a question for you. When Fire District 10 when you accepted, Portland accepted the contract with Fire District 10, wasn't Portland or Fire District 10, somebody, weren't they under the obligation to notify PERS that a transfer of employers had taken place?
Senator Walker, Chair Menace, PERS was notified by Fire District 10 that they had terminated employees and notified by Portland that they had taken on employees.
Is that in writing?
Yes, it was, Senator.
I'm just kind of concerned because we have a lot of things that aren't in writing. So it was in writing that PERS was notified of the termination and the transfer. And so PERS was on notice in 1984 that Portland now had responsibility for these employees under PERS.
Senator Walker, I don't know whether they were notified that there had been a transfer of employees. They had been notified by District 10 that they had terminated an employee with District 10. They had been notified by Portland that they had been hired by Portland and that they were PERS employees now working for the city of Portland in a police and fire position.
Do we have copies of that notification somewhere?
Senator Walker, I believe that PERS would have copies of that notification.
Because that rests heavily in PERS' lap, if that is true.
All right. Senator Metzger, keep in mind, by the way, any of the solutions here is like a balloon. You step on one end, it gets bigger on the other. Equity is the issue here, I think, hopefully. Senator Metzger.
Thank you. On that same topic, and I certainly appreciate your analysis of this in terms of being forthright and timely with payments that are due and responsibility to notify. Notwithstanding that, when the city of Portland made this $250-some-odd million payment against the unfunded liability, the tax base that from the taxpayers who paid essentially those dollars that allowed the city to pay that was at that time was part of the tax base of the city, was part of Fire District 10's original tax base, part of at least part of that in the city of Portland at the time that this payment was made.
Senator Metzger, Chair Menace, yes, the city annexed about 65% of Fire District 10. Of the total district, and so that is part of the city of Portland tax base, yes.
So one can make the assumption, and this is where I'm going at this, and I know at the time you made this payment, you disputed the Fire District 10 liability part, but one would make the assumption that at least a significant number of Fire District 10 taxpayers did pay as part of that $40 million that at that time, anyway, was being charged to the city of Portland for Fire District 10. Some of those dollars came from Fire District 10 taxpayers. Regardless of an ultimate change in assessment to Fire District 10, there were citizens who actually paid taxes that went to that payment and could make a claim that they were paying at least part of that liability at that time.
Senator Metzger, Chairman, that's a logical argument, and in fact, yes, 65% of that tax base was within the city of Portland, so we could accrue some of that to those folks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, thank you very much. You're finished, right?
Yes, sir.
Sir, you're next.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. I'm Terry McCall, Finance and Management Services Director for the city of Gresham. Gresham recommends and requests that the unfunded liability be absorbed by PERS. We also strongly recommend against any other allocation formula that you might be presented with. Allocating any amount on a pro rata share to the district and the five cities involved would be unacceptable to us. Gresham did not employ any of those employees employ any of those folks, as you have already heard. PERS created the problem by not communicating with our jurisdictions and probably by not following its own internal policies. For them to have waited for 13 years to announce a liability is really beyond comprehension. For them to ask for the money 13 years later is way beyond my comprehension. I was a bank vice president prior to working for Gresham, and in my 27 years of working for the bank, had a similar delay occurred, and had we had the cheek to have asked for a settlement, we would have been laughed away, and had it gone to court, the bank would have lost. you can check with any bank and can verify that even in situations involving less time and less money, that would have been the case. Banks carry loss reserve accounts, and that's where we would have paid the loss from. That PERS may not have had a reserve is not an excuse. It is simply mismanagement. If there is not a legal statute of limitations, there is certainly, in my mind, a moral one. All of our cities are struggling to balance our budgets and to provide essential services to our citizens. In Gresham alone, our employer rate has increased in 1 year from 8.83% to 11.8%, a little over $1 million. And that's after the recent reforms. And we feel that some of this increase may be attributable to the poor investment climate, and yet a large part of the escalating costs is due in part to past PERS administrative decisions which fly in the face of prudent management principles. So on these basis, I beg you to not add to our misery by letting PERS simply pass the buck for its own serious mistakes. Leave the liability there where it belongs.
All right. Thank you, Mr. McCall. Thank you. Appreciate your testimony. Mr. Boyko, when did you come to work for PERS?
It was March of 2000.
March of 2000. Okay. It wasn't 1997. All right. Thank you very much. I've got some other folks that would like to testify. With the committee's indulgence, if you can stay a few more minutes, and then I'd like to try to get people on. Wendy Johnson, I'm going to skip over you because I think you're going to talk about law commission component of the bill. Ms. Keltner, Hacienda Squires, and Paul Snyder. I don't know if you want to all come up at the same time. Since you, I think, all have similar interests. Yes, no, maybe? Ms. Keltner? How are you today?
Thank you.
Good. And has Hacienda anywhere in the building? Well, Paul, why don't you go ahead and tell us what you want to tell us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, I'm Paul Snyder, representing Association of Oregon Counties, and I regret to say I didn't know very much about this issue before this morning, except to say that in looking at the -B8 and the -B9 amendments, if I read them correctly, they seem to indicate that one of the solutions to this problem would be to spread the liability among all the other PERS employers. And although that reduces the individual liabilities of particular PERS employers, it nonetheless creates liability for PERS employers that have absolutely nothing to do with this issue, that didn't know anything about it, couldn't have done anything about it, were in no position to find out anything about it, and shouldn't really be stuck with the cost of paying for it.
Can I ask you a question, though, on that point? I understand why you object, but to the extent that it's an uncollectible debt, doesn't it happen vicariously anyway? If Fire District 10 couldn't pay the debt if their life depended on it, and if the legislature didn't do something, you know, that brought the money in from some other resource, wouldn't you ultimately have to pay it anyway? Wouldn't they have to assume the rates? Because that obligation exists in the system.
Mr. Chair, I don't know the answer to that question. Somebody would have to pick up the debt because the employees
would get their benefits. Notwithstanding, we know that. That's a contractual obligation. It's going to get paid.
I'd be inclined to say, you know, we're looking for something that's an equitable solution to a very sticky problem, and I do appreciate that difficulty. But one of the issues that I would look at in trying to craft a solution is to take a look at where the employees were employed and for whose benefit their employment occurred. Who, you know, that they were employed by a government entity, they provided a service to the people within the jurisdiction of that entity, and one of the obligations, one of the benefits of having performed that service is to have their PERS costs covered by the entity that employed them.
But we know, and I think Senator Metzger pointed out, we know that 65% of the taxpayer base is in the city of Portland, so I think you're assuming that at least to that extent, 65% of the obligation should be spread to the city of Portland.
That might be one of the ways to look at it, Mr. Chair. It's a difficult issue because there were people who worked for different entities. And I've listened to the dialogue this morning, and the city of Portland seems to have a good point, and Fire District 10 seems to have some good points, and so does the Public Employees Retirement Board. But to spread the obligation among jurisdictions that had no clue about the problem and no way to deal with it or remedy it also seems to be inequitable. Well,
I appreciate the testimony. Who's next? Ms. Keltner?
I actually didn't. Maria Keltner. I work with the Association of Oregon Counties, and I actually signed up on the list as a party of interest, not understanding that it was a witness list.
That's interesting. You've been in this building a long time. You know what a witness list looks like. Anyway, I appreciate that. Do you have any specific testimony?
I would not at
you
this
just
point
agree with
add
Paul?
To what I would not add to what
I think
Paul
we've
said.
Identified
at this
the
point.
Guilty party, Mr. Chairman.
Well, Mr. Chairman, if I could just make an observation, I think Mr. Snyder makes a point that our employers had no clue. I don't think anybody had any clue on this one. I think everybody's in the same boat.
Well, and actually it gets me to this. I mean, we're in this session now trying to fix Tier 1, Tier 2, and create a successor system and try to clean the slate to some degree. And this is an outstanding issue that needs a solution.
If I could add, I would be willing to help work on resolving the issue if we can find something that's equitable. But as you said, when you step
you
on
flexible?
One side...
Are you flexible? I want to know if you're flexible.
I do yoga most mornings.
All right. Asina, do you have anything that you want to add, or are you... were you forced to sign up, too?
Mr. Prince forced me to sign up. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Hussein Esquire is on behalf of the Special District Association of Oregon. I would just like to, I think the chair makes a good point in the issue of wouldn't somebody have to fund this anyway if Multnomah County 10 couldn't fund it? And I think PERS and at the board level, we've had some, there's been discussion of what would actually occur if an employer was unable to pay, and that might be an avenue that worth pursuing that has attempted to be pursued in the past. With respect to the amendments that were circulated, I would like to point out that we strongly support the language in here requiring employers at the time they merge, consolidate, annex, to require in writing that they address these issues. You'd be surprised, even at the level of sophistication of some of our larger districts who have not. They're so focused on where the fire station is going to be located or how many employees they're going to have and retain or lose and all those types of issues that this, in the past, since PERS has not been such a hot topic, has not really risen to the level of what liability are we taking on and what are we not. Much more so now, we're seeing employers call and ask, have you seen City of Gladstone's, for instance, valuation statement? What's their liability look like? Can I get a copy of that? We get that more often now, but we'd really encourage this language requiring written agreements to be adopted.
Right. Thank you. Any other questions, comments, political diatribe?
Political
diatribe, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, after reflecting on the testimony from the City of Portland, when they said they hadn't been billed by PERS for 13 years, well, that's true, but they knew the liability existed when they took on the fire district. So you know the liability exists. You kind of hope you don't get billed by the IRS or whoever you owe money to, but you still owe it.
Mr. Chairman,
don't you agree?
To push back a little bit in the diatribe department. that's the whole point. The whole assumption was that the liability had been taken care of in the existing rate structure. There was no indication that there was a special liability out there that hadn't already been accounted for.
Correct. It had not been acknowledged as a separate entity.
Good pushback, Senator Murray.
You know, I almost feel like bringing Fred Neal up from the Secretary of State's office because Fred actually staffed the Intergovernmental Affairs Committee back in 1985 with the freshman legislator. We spent inordinate hours talking about annexations and such. So he could probably shed some light on what legislative intent might have been back then. All righty then. Mr. Voico, I'm going to give you a rejoinder here. Mr. Hendricks, you want to come up? And then I'm going to try to assign a group of people to come up with an equitable solution. And if that's not possible, then we'll see if the committee wants to go a specific direction. If not, we'll throw our hands up and walk away.
Mr. Chair, could I make sure that Mr. Voitko, I don't know if he's going to address this, but I do want him to address the Attorney for Fire District 10's interpretation of the statute that indicated that the responsibility transfer.
Correct.
ORS
236-620. Correct.
Chair Minnis and members of the committee, I appreciate an opportunity for rejoinder. I'll be very brief, and as I began with four comments, I'll end with four. First, let me take on the issue of what I think was the most unacceptable behavior of the agency that I now head. And even though, as you were kind enough to point out, I was not present at the time, I am now, and I will say that the decision by PERS not to bill anybody for an extended period of time for this liability was not proper. It was not actuarially sound. In the scheme of the size of PERS, it was not terribly material, but it was not appropriate. That said, I do want to say that because I think as legislators you want to know, are we doing anything about it? And I, part of the reason that we're here today is obviously we're taking up these issues one at a time, beginning with the most important ones, and we're going to clean the book. Two is we have submitted a legislative concept, which I believe is embedded now in one of the amendments that you have before you, to try to clarify this issue of past liabilities for employers who merge. We submitted that to DAS and the governor's office in the last just prior to the last session. Because of the press of other PERS legislation, it was temporarily set aside. But I do want you to, I want to leave you with the impression that this is an agency that doesn't like what happened in Fire District 10 and is going to do everything we can not to make it happen again, not to let it happen again. We've also proposed a rule to our board to clarify these issues. We're also dealing with each one of these issues in turn, and some we've dealt with successfully. Steve Matten mentioned Harney County. This is one where there was a dispute, and the three parties got together, PERS and the hospital district and the county, and it was resolved satisfactorily, very much in line with the policy that we have in the rule and in the legislative concept that you have before you. We have two additional processes going on now, both promising, with Marion County Data Center and an organization, a consortium formed by the universities called OATC. We have been aggressive, so aggressive, in fact, in trying to resolve these sooner rather than later, that we actually used for the first time in the agency's history our power to subpoena records, which we did from OATC, so that we could ascertain what the agreements were between the universities when they created this entity. We hope that Fire District 10 maybe is an unfortunate set of facts, but we're trying to do everything we can not to make history repeat itself. Thank you for allowing me to say that. Just a couple of other things. I learned a lot from the testimony today as well, and I particularly would draw your attention to the chronology in the 1995 period, where in the chronology provided to you by your staff, it says that a Multnomah District 10 board member inquired of their auditor as to what obligations they might have to PERS. At the same time, the attorney for the district has said that the article, I believe it was 12 if I remember correctly, it, prior to the agreement in 1995, assigned all other, and I understand from Senator Ringo's comments that it is kind of general and a catch-all, but all other liabilities to Portland. And I don't know whether that was Portland's understanding at the time. Mr. Manton says no. But what's interesting is that right after that point at 1995, the two parties, according to the representative from Fire District 10, created an agreement which absolved Portland and released Portland from that blanket obligation, and that's why they can't proceed against Portland. One of the things that we will do for this committee is to try to figure out whether or not there were any communications from the agency at that time to Portland that indicated that, or any other party, that indicated that the account for Fire District 10 had been kept open, because it had been, we know that for a fact, that it in fact had had a separate liability tracked for it, because we know that that is also a fact, and we would typically send statements for employers, even subsidiary employers, out to either directly to them, and we're going to research that because, again, this is such a twisted history that even at this point in time, we're finding that there's some potential other documents out there that may be interesting. And with respect to Mr. Manton's testimony about whether or not Portland's protest was documented, I can only say under oath that, in fact, it was said to me on multiple occasions. In fact, I personally visited their office on this issue. But it may also be reflected in board minutes because it was, we believe it was raised to our board in public testimony, and we will track that to see if we can provide that to your staff. The final comment that I make, that I want to make, is that when anybody says PERS should pay, you should immediately read all other employers should pay, because PERS total assets are zero. We hold assets only for our plan sponsors for the sole purpose of paying benefits to their employees. So to the extent that any solution requires PERS to pay, what that means in essence is that all other employers pay. So I want to make clear.
Although, Mr. Rucka, and I don't disagree with that, isn't there part of your underlying actuarial assumption that you're going to have certain debts that are not collectible? Do you assume that every single debt is collectible in your assumptions?
Chair Minnis, I believe we actually do.
Isn't that rather silly?
Not really, because we've been very effective in getting collection, and with this notable exception. In fact, in the car on the way down, I asked my CFO whether or not we have ever had to take action against an employer for failure to pay their contribution, and he said, in no one's memory has it ever happened.
All right. So in this notable exception, there seems to be an issue or a problem. Is that accurate?
At the moment, yes.
Oh, okay.
Mr. Chair, may I follow up on that line?
Yeah, Representative Anderson.
I had heard that in prior time, PERS didn't have a contingency fund, but now you do. Can you tell us when the contingency fund occurred or happened, how much is in it, and how do you determine what amount of money goes into it?
I would be happy to, Chair Minnis, Representative Munoz Anderson, and Mr. Hendricks, who worked directly with the legislature and with us on SB 134 that defined the new version of the contingency reserve, can chime in at any time. First, let me answer the easy question. How much money is in the contingency reserve? Zero. That begs the question of whether or not we could debit that account, like we do for the gain loss reserve, where we have a debit of some billions of dollars, and pay it back to ourselves later. The second thing is that prior to the last regular session, the uses for the contingency fund were very limited and quite vague. And the legislature created two versions of, in SB 134, two versions of the contingency account, and expanded their uses, that is, the allowable uses that the agency could put that money to. The one that's most particularly relevant of the two is what's called the Employer Insolvency Reserve, which is funded solely by employers, and one of the uses of it is to, in situations like this, but the employer has to be insolvent, whatever that means. We've not had the situation. We may be required by a court to exhaust all capabilities of getting the funds necessary before using it. That is an open-ended question because it's never been tested. But again, three, it goes back to the point that I made to Chair Minnis, and that is that it is funded by employers, so using those funds is the same thing as spreading it among all other employers. I don't know if Mr. Hendricks wants to expand on my summary of the contingency account.
Chairman, this members of the committee, Dave Hendricks, Senior Deputy Legislative Counsel. No. The only thing I would mention is that spreading these debts to other employers, and in the case of the contingency fund, you're basically looking at future earnings on the fund in order to pay off this type of debt. If you do that, one way or the other, it comes out of the pockets of employers. I mean, it's easy to say, well, it's just interest, you know, that hasn't been earned yet, so nobody has a real claim to it. But it still does end up, in one way or the other, being reflected in rates charged to employers. And one of the issues that's going to raise is going to be some challenge based on an unfunded mandate by the Legislative Assembly under the constitutional provision. And I just would mention, I have not researched that in depth. Both the B8 and the B9 amendments raise that question. My understanding is that PERS has asked, and they allowed me kindly to mention this, an opinion from the Attorney General about that particular question, and are waiting to get a positive answer back from them.
And Mr. Chairman, if it is ruled an unfunded mandate, then as I understand it, the only thing that would do is it would require a 3/5 vote as opposed to a majority vote. That it would still be constitutional to do that. It just requires a higher threshold. I'm asking the question.
Yeah. I'm trying to remember how you override the unfunded mandate provision. Pre-fiscal still comes into play. The primary mechanism is, I know that if you don't go through the right hoops, that individual employers can decline to comply with the mandate, which would mean that individual employers would not send in that portion of the contribution that they make that reflects this change. But PERS had told me very roughly at one point that they were looking at it, and I don't know if it was under B8 or B9, that you were looking at a system-wide increase of approximately 0.06% of payroll. And what that means is that approximately 2/3 of this cost would be paid for by the state and by the school districts. And since they make up approximately 2/3 of the PERS contributions, basically, that's where the money would come from if you took one of these two options.
Can I follow up on my question, please?
Yeah.
When you have a retirement pension plan, I hear it approximately 10% comes from the employer, 10% from the employee, and the rest is on investments. To me, it seems incredibly important. I mean, I don't know how that works. I'm just throwing that concept out. It seems to me incredibly important to have a contingency fund if some of that money is going to come from investments. So in a sense, we should have like a rainy day fund or a contingency fund, and there should be a part of the rate that there's a certain amount that goes into it so that when we go into down years like we have in the last couple of years, that there is this reserve.
Chairman, Representative Mona Sanderson, the problem with PERS and with retirement systems generally is that they operate under fiduciary responsibilities and tax qualification requirements that are imposed on them that put certain limits on their ability to do the things that a private company would do. And one of those limitations is that the monies in the fund have to be used for the benefit of the members. And this was part of a very long conversation we had last session with respect to Senate Bill 134 when we were rewriting the contingency reserve language, in that you have to be able to identify specific things that you're setting money aside because it's money that would otherwise be available to fund benefits for members. And people could object if you set up a reserve just to have a reserve in case something happens. You can't do that. You have to have specific things. One of the specific things we added last session was insolvency of one of the employers. And it's a fair question. Well, why haven't we worried about that before? Well, we've never had an insolvency. B, A, we've never had an insolvency. B, there's some real question about whether or not there could ever be a true insolvency in a public body of this type, a public body with taxing authority. To the extent we could find any guidance on this, and there's not very much, the bottom line is that it's very possible that the bankruptcy court would not allow any public employer with a tax base to simply walk away from a debt, because the assumption is that the taxpayers are still there, and the taxpayers can eventually be required to raise the revenues to pay the debt.
Although in this case, with fires for 10 years, they pay a dollar exactly. down and a dollar a month in perpetuity. So,
yeah. Correct. If in fact, although I would say too, the other interesting thing about this, it seems to me that the debt that was incurred here was by Fire District 10 that represented a certain tax base, a certain area in which people live.
65% of which
and received service.
And received services. And they took on this debt, which is what they did when they integrated. They said, we agreed we'll take on $15 million of debt. Now, those things have all been gone different ways through annexation and...
But the interesting thing, Mr. Hendricks, is that if you look at the document, they transferred equipment. They transferred the whole bailiwick. It wasn't just the employees. They didn't sell off existing assets. They took the whole thing as if it was a single entity. And now it becomes part of Portland. To me, the underlying assumption is all of those other obligations go along with it, absent some language that says otherwise.
I think it's probably the other way around.
But the paradox we find ourselves in here is the entities that are at loggerheads over this have agreed not to sue each other. So how do you get the controversy resolved absent the legislature stepping in and fixing it or finding a solution? And I don't think litigation is a good solution. Bankruptcy is not a good solution, I think, as you suggest. I'll tell you what I'm going to do because I want to kind of move this along. I've kind of arrived at a decision as the chair. I'm asking Senator Ferrioli and Senator Walker to chair a work group. And I'm going to ask, and they've agreed to do this, Mr. Voico and Mr. Madden, I think, City of Portland, City of Gresham, since you want to be involved, Mr. Snyder, and I assume League of Oregon Cities would be represented to some degree by Gresham and Portland in this, Mr. Ellsworth, Mr. Hendricks, and other interested parties that they want to bring in. I put Mr. Green from the Oregon School Boards Association because he came to me and said there are other entities, but I'm not sure how much they play into this. But what I guess I'd like to see is if we can come up with an equitable solution to this legislatively to try to wipe the slate clean if possible. And I literally recused myself from this because I represent this area for the most part, and that may be malfeasance on the part of my constituents. But I just think that none of us who actually have a vested interest in representing those cities should really play a critical role in finding an equitable solution at this juncture. We can speak into it, but I don't want to be the person that says, thou shalt do X, Y, Z. I want to leave it to a couple of members who I have confidence in and the parties to come to the table. Now, if anybody out there who I've named feels like they can't do that, they can't come to an equitable solution or unwilling to do that, let me know. Ms. Roberts, anybody else? I want everybody. I want a love fest is what I want. I'd like an answer here. I kind of see that there's potentially some answers. I think the $40 million question is outstanding, 65% of the territory being in Portland and so on and so forth. I think there are some pathways to try to resolve the issue, but I'd like to find something if we can. I think the malfeasance, if you will, of the prior existing PERBS administration plays into this to some degree, as does the spreading of the debt to all other cities and municipalities that didn't participate and weren't really responsible. And I think the legislature, from the legislative perspective, what hopefully we're doing this session is reforming PERS to the degree that we have better management, better expectations of what the numbers look like in cities and counties, schools, et cetera, can have better assumptions underlying what their costs are going to be, because heretofore it's been pretty hit and miss, and it needs to change, because I think one of the business people from downtown Portland said the state needs to get its financial house in order before many of us are going to come along on other propositions, and I think PERS is really a major part of that. Senator Farrell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The only request that I would have in accepting your charge is
3 more weeks of session?
No.
Just a clear charge to the committee about what 2 or 3 questions you'd like us to answer, to bring back to this committee and make decisions on.
All right.
And we can discuss that. I'd like to suggest a meeting between Senator Walker, myself, and the chairman of the committee to set parameters around the issues that you'd like us to get clarity on.
All right. That's good. And I think we can include the other representatives affected to have that discussion. But I think we're all on the same page. Anybody else out there want to say something? Political diatribes? Unions.
The firemen.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Bob Livingston, representing the Oregon State Firefighters. Just a comment quickly. Just, I guess, what I would be asking for is a hall pass, certainly, in these discussions, while we believe that this is an issue for employers to try to resolve, along with the PERS agency. Certainly, my organization does represent people that potentially, depending on what the decisions are, could be impacted by this, and we would just hopefully not necessarily have the intent of being major players within the committee, but certainly would like to be able to monitor those and kind of watch how that goes, if we could.
I think you'll be free to monitor, but I honestly can't see how you're going to be adversely affected. I think if anything, it will benefit you. So,
thank
all
you,
right,
Mr. Chair.
Any other questions, comments?
Senator Walker. Yeah, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hendricks just briefly touched on the issue of bankruptcy and whether a district that can tax itself can file bankruptcy. Well, Orange County filed under Chapter 9 several years ago, and they can certainly tax themselves, and they were in bankruptcy. The issue is, if Fire District 10 files bankruptcy, though, and discharges its debt, it goes back to PERS, and PERS has to fund it anyway. So yeah, it doesn't really get us anywhere.
Yeah, and I just think that the analogy that I kind of make is that, you know, you mentioned the word malfeasance about PERS, and if they had an employee that embezzled, you know, $40 million from the PERS fund, it's employers who have to pay for that. I mean, that just, when something happens wrong, whether it's somebody embezzling or some loss of money due to PERS, there's nobody else to pay for it but the employers.
Right. Well, I guess what I can hope, my hope above all else is that we can come up with a reasonably equitable solution and kind of clear the slate on this discussion so we can move on if possible, so we don't have to revisit it in 2005. So that, we're good.
After 14 pages of...